Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Next Monday, February 4th, On Guard Arts, an award-winning nonprofit theatrical production company, is launching a new monthly series called Uncommon Voices in association with WBAI and the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. They're opening with an evening of 10-minute plays under the overall title Truth and Reconciliation of Women. It's curated by Tony Award-winning actress, writer, director, producer, and activist Tonya Pickens, and she joins us now, along with Ann Hamburger, the founder of On Guard Arts. Welcome to our show.
Thanks, Leonard. Good
Ann,
to see you.
This new series is being presented at the Commons Cafe at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, in association with BAI. Has On Guard Arts done anything like this in the past?
On Guard Arts was founded in 1986 when I put site-specific theater on the map in New York City, producing artists like Ann Bogart, Chuck Mee, Tina Landau. I then left New York for almost a decade and ran a global division for Disney, and then came back to New York in 2013 and relaunched the company with work revolving around social change. For me, the Cafe series is very exciting because it allows me to give support to artists developing work around social change that I think are brilliant and talented, like Tonya Pickens, and I'm so appreciative of the work she's doing with her anthology of pieces.
Well, but it'll be every Monday at the
It'll be
Brooklyn
the first Monday of every month is how we're starting. And so
that's really ambitious.
And each Monday is a different artist. Yeah. So this Monday, February 4th, will be Truth and Reconciliation of Women.
Well, Tonya, how did you come to curate these performances?
You know, I was privileged to be in the inside rooms of the Time's Up Now movement before it went public in January of 2018. And so I got to witness the most powerful women in Hollywood negotiating how they were going to take a stand about the Me Too movement and sexual harassment and 50-50 by 2020. And sitting in those rooms and watching that, I became very interested in the ways in which women, even in these rooms with the intentions to help each other, were also unconsciously silencing each other and depressing each other. And so I thought, let me reach out to people and get some stories, not only about what that looks like, but what would have needed to have happened in those moments to have healed it so that people could move forward. And so that was the prompt I sent out in January 2008. And now I have about 16 plays, 2 songs, and I continue to collect plays from the diaspora of women, cultures, countries, ethnicities, and on Monday night we're going to be putting on 5 plays and 2 songs.
Haven't you called yourself an artivist?
I have.
That's a mixture of artist and activist. And does it cover all of your pursuits? Because, as I said, you have this long list of credits: actress, writer, director, producer, activist, and now you're adding to that curator.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, even when I do my cabaret, which I just did in December, it's very much around social justice. We talked a lot about immigration and suicide and things that matter to me. I'm the other side of my life, and I want to make sure that I leave something behind that will make the world a little bit better where I was in
it. You actually used the word crone once. I can't believe anybody would use that word to describe myself. I am a proud crone woman. No.
Yes, I am.
That is a pejorative word used against women.
No, it's used by other people to be against women, but for me, I use it very proudly. It means you have lived long enough to reach that age when you are wise and your resources are no longer being spent on others, but you are using them for your own self and generating your own creativity.
Do you think that actors have a greater responsibility as public figures? Because some feel the urge to do it, and then others, and sometimes they criticize for doing it.
I think it's a choice. I think that it is definitely something you have to be called to. I think for there's many people who do it and who shouldn't do it because they aren't smart enough, they aren't articulate enough, they don't know how to take the challenges that are going to come at you when you step out like that. So it's definitely a calling. And if you don't feel called, you shouldn't let anybody push you into it because it's not an easy path to walk.
Because sometimes people go after you. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
Truth and Reconciliation of Women, this group of 10 plays, is it important that the word women is spelled W-O-M-Y-N?
It is. You know, we argue about that sometimes, like, do we need men inside our name? But then I said to my friends when we coined that phrase, I said, but the Y could be Y chromosome, so we still got men inside there. But I just like the Y, and a group of women that I'm in circle with, that's the way we do it. And we use wild, and we spell wild with a Y as well.
And the term Truth and Reconciliation has usually been applied to commissions in countries with troubled histories, South Africa, Liberia, Peru, Colombia, Myanmar, Cambodia, Germany, even Canada. How do you see it as being applied here?
The beauty of the Truth and Reconciliation Project in South Africa, and it is a model, was that people were allowed to come forward and speak their truths without being attacked. And it meant that you could speak your truth about the things that you had done, and people could say to you what they felt as well. So no one was being told you have to be politically correct. And so that is what I've asked of these writers. I have not told them what healing looks like. I've said, write the moment in your life or in history that you want to see corrected. Show me how you would have made it correct. So we're trying to model something that existed in life, but I feel like the brain does not show us the world as it is. It shows us a prediction. And theater is that ideal place to start building files for people predicting a better world. So this is theater to show people that healing can be a win-win for everybody.
And all of these plays were written after you made the request? Give me a 10-minute play?
I said I wanted 10-minute plays, 10-minute songs. I have one about the sexual slavery of Filipino, Chinese, and Korea women in Japan. I have one about the Taino women and the Spanish women in South America. I have one about the forced sterilization of Puerto Rican women by the U.S.
An escape from an abusive relationship.
Another
one is an LGBT woman navigating daily life and perceptions.
Yeah, and I have one even from my viewpoint inside the Time's Up movement.
Yours,
yeah.
Because you have contributed one of the plays.
One of the ones. I've written a few of the plays, but one for Monday night.
Also, the other playwrights, Glory Cadogan, Christine M. Reyes, Carmen Rivera, Lucy Thurber, and then Stories and Songs by composers Julie Brown and Angela Scalfani. Have you worked with them before?
I have not worked with Angela or Julie before. I saw Angela's work because I sat on a panel to give a fellowship to Music Theater Factory Makers. Julie and I are friends. We sit in circle together. G. Cadogan, I just directed her play Till We Meet Again at the 14th Street Y. And Christine is a friend, and I really just reached out to writers I respect. I love Lucy Thurber. I sat on the committee that gave her an Obie. So these are artists that I respect.
And are you directing all of these?
For Monday night, I am, but we will be at the Heal Me Too Festival at IRT Theaters in March and April, which will be their 3 Sunday nights. And then we'll be at the 14th Street Y every weekend in July. So for those other larger productions, I will be bringing in other directors.
And what about the actors?
The actors, there's a company of about 20 actresses, and because, you know, there's not a lot of money in nonprofit artivism, the actors come in and out as their work allows, but everybody's been really generous with their time and their talent because they feel very strongly that the work is important.
And how did this partnership begin? And where did the idea for the series come from?
The idea for the series came from me since I've been back, since I moved back to New York City from Los Angeles. I've been doing
this. Are you happy to be back?
I'm so happy to be back.
Because I guess there are three or four cities in the country that I could live in. Los Angeles is one of them. But
well, I worked for Disney running a global division, and it was a great place to bring up my kids for a period of time, and I felt like
better weather.
I learned a lot traveling around the world, but New York is my home, and theater's my love and my heart, and I really, much like Tanya said, started to feel when I came back to New York after I'd been gone for so many years, I said to myself, who am I? What's needed, and how can I make a difference at this point in my life? And so against all reason and sanity, I decided to relaunch En Garde Arts. I mean, who starts a not-for-profit theater twice? But the shows that we've been doing have been very complicated, very large scale. We did a show called Bass Track Live that was at BAM on the Harvey stage that went to 40 cities. And these shows take 2 years, to sometimes more, to develop. And so for me personally, it was very frustrating to say, oh my God, I can only do one major show every couple of years. I'm not supporting enough artists to be happy. And so actually the station manager from WBAI came and saw our last show and was blown away by it. It was called Red Hills. It was actually set in Rwanda.
Bertolt Reamer.
And said... Bertolt, yeah, and said, is there a partnership here? So when I came and saw the cafe and talked to Bertolt and thought, oh my God, if I were to do a series in this cafe, it would give me the opportunity to support so many more artists than I can doing these big, big shows. And this is a way to connect with people that everybody makes a little bit of money, but the important thing is people really taking risks and really taking on important social issues in a way that's important but also enjoyable, that uses the arts and theater for what it can do, which is bringing people together in a room, sparking conversation, building community, combating isolation. So I met Tanya in, believe it or not, we were both in Los Angeles when we were trick-or-treating on the streets with our children through a mutual friend. And then we reconnected in New York. And when I became aware of what she was doing, I was so blown away and moved by all of the time and energy and effort that she was putting into this series of work. And, you know, without embarrassing Tanya on the radio, I mean, she's got one of the most extraordinary musical voices of anybody I've ever heard sing. She's got this amazing acting career.
Oh, I left out singer.
And so I'm so appreciative of someone like Tanya, who has a major acting career, who has purposely decided to, out of love and commitment and wanting to make the world a better place, committed herself not only to promoting her own voice, which a lot of well-known actors do, but in promoting the voices of others, of a community of women. And that's what I think makes this so extraordinary. Plus, I do want to emphasize, it's going to be a fun evening. It's not just all dark and gloom. And the cafe is wonderful because you can have a glass of wine, you can have some food, you can be together with 70 people and watch some great theater.
But you are also artists who are engaged in collaborative efforts, whatever you do, whether you're making movies, whether you're doing plays. It's different than I used to be a painter, you know, being alone in a room wondering whether I was doing anything of any value. You get a lot of feedback when you're collaborating with other people. But I was wondering about the whole business of doing a nonprofit. What happens if you have great successes and lots of people come? Aren't you making a profit?
When you think about the costs of doing things, there's not usually a profit. I mean, theater really costs a lot of money. Even you just think about the photocopying. The photocopying of scripts, very, very expensive. You know, giving people honorariums even. I think when theater, what did they say? You can either make a killing or get killed.
Yeah. You know, because not-for-profits keep their ticket prices low, the expenses are always way more than the income that they're, that not-for-profit theaters are receiving. And so it's a labor of love. And that's why it's so important to get government funding, to get money from the NEA, to get foundations who are coming on board, to get individual philanthropists to be writing checks. Because when you're doing work, especially work like this, that's where you're taking risks, it's particularly difficult, right? You're not trying to do something very commercial that's going to be the next Broadway show.
But when you have a well-known name like Tanya Pinkins associated, are you taking all that much of a risk?
You're taking a risk with Tanya Pinkins because you know Tanya Pinkins is going to say what she thinks. Uh-huh. And so that becomes
a
risk for people.
Sometimes.
Exactly.
Where you don't have Tanya Pinkins on stage doing Singing in the Rain. So
right, you would never get me to do that.
So we are talking with Anne Hamburger, who is the creator of On Guard Arts, an award-winning nonprofit theatrical production company. Also made films, haven't you? Did you make a documentary?
I've made documentary theater. So the
Theater. Okay.
The shows that I did a show called Wilderness that was about parents trying to connect with their troubled teens, and we had real parents on video screens as part of the show. But it's live theater.
We're talking about a series called Uncommon Voices, which begins next Monday at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, and then there'll be different performances every month, the first of every month, right?
The first Monday of every month, yeah. In March, we have a wonderful theater company named Lub Dub Theater, and in April, we have a solo performance artist doing a piece about climate change named Tanya Kalmanovich. So it's, yes, the first Monday of every month.
And this Monday at 7:30, we begin with a group of 10-minute plays under the overall title Truth and Reconciliation of Women. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. We've been moving toward this question, Tanya. Early on in your career, you said that you felt that women had to be likable and pleasing. Now you say that you're in the third stage of a woman's life, a crone, a wise woman. So you've given up on the idea of you strike me as a rather pleasing person.
I think I'm very, very pleasing. but I'm at that point in my life where one of my friends said, you know, it's like spring cleaning, only it's people. It's like whenever I have to go, I say to people, if it's a choice between you being happy and me being happy, I choose me. And I don't think you can get there until you're a crone. Prior to that, your resources are being spent on your husband, your children, your lovers, your job. And then you reach a point where just hormonally, all of that changes. And it's like, I don't have that much time left. What am I going to do? My children are going off. My husband's doing his thing. What am I going to do that's going to be my personal legacy? And that's where I've been for the last few years. Like, what am I going to leave?
Can women be assertive and strong without being labeled in terms that have negative connotations, like aggressive?
I think it depends on who you talk to. Like working at Disney for 10 years, I really saw the difference between strong, forceful feminine executives and strong, forceful male executives and how they were perceived, treated, and labeled.
You want to elucidate? Do you want to go a little further in that? How were they treated differently? I'm getting the feeling that the men were treated better or given more money, perhaps? Power?
I think you said there's certain words that I can't say on the radio.
Yes.
But there's a B word I'm thinking of. Women were called pushy.
I think you could say that word, but it's okay.
You can?
Oh, that's not on the list.
That's not on the list.
That is not on the list.
It means female dog, doesn't it?
I'm sure I was, I was a, there were, among certain people, I was a pushy bitch from New York because I had a lot of courage and I stood up for what I believed in. And one time a very senior executive at Disney said, you're twice as good as anybody else doing your job, because if a woman gets to be an executive vice president like you did, they have to be twice as good.
Mm. Did you take that as a compliment?
I actually did.
And I think that I don't even want to focus on that anymore. I think these plays are about, hey, women, we're a little bit more than 50% of the world. If we can heal the division that we have between us, we can run the world. We don't have to go to anybody for permission. It's so much easier to get forgiveness than it is to get permission. So these plays are about showing women the power and joy of working together, working through whatever problem you may have is going to be so much more rewarding than trying to get acceptance and approval from anybody outside of your own community.
Do you expect most of the people in the audience to be women?
The last time we presented in at Deepak Home Base, I would say it was about 50-50 men and women. Yeah. And I found that men found it incredible as well. I think there
The kind of men who would come to this kind of performance men who are receptive, I would
say. Men who are receptive to truth and reconciliation. And what we did is I had a pre-show and a post-show questionnaire because I'm interested in, is this idea that seeing models of what the life is good as can actually change people? And so I asked people, if they felt they needed to make amends with anyone or if anyone owed them amends. And then after the show, I asked people the same series of questions to see if a difference had been made. And, you know, my sample was very, very small, but most of the people felt that they either were owed amends or owed someone amends, and they were willing to admit that. And so there was this slight sense of shift. So I feel like that's what we're doing. We're planting the seeds for that. We're laying the path for that.
Do you like doing Q&As after performance?
I do. I feel like so many people in the world need a space to be heard, and we are not getting it on social media. We do not, and that's people are like speaking out into the emptiness because they're looking for connection. So I want to create that in theater spaces.
And I'm assuming that you're hoping that as people are leaving the theater or afterward, that they will still be talking about the issues that were brought up by the plays that you're presenting.
Absolutely. I got involved in this when I was doing Rashida speaking at the New Group with Diane Wiest, Joel Drake Johnson's play, and I curated all of the talkbacks for that play because it was very challenging, the text. Very, very challenging text. And I felt that there was no way I could responsibly be involved if there wasn't some conversation about what was on the stage and what people were feeling. And literally 90% of the people in that audience stayed for 40 minutes and wanted to stay longer because we are such a segregated society, New York being one of the most segregated cities in the country, and there's no place for people to have these difficult conversations.
You're talking about racial and ethnic segregation?
Yeah.
And economic.
And so we made a place where people could have those conversations. And it's 4 years later, and people come up to me and tell me they made a friend in that talk back who they still connect with because they now have someone that they can ask that awkward thing.
You think New York is more segregated than, let's say, Chicago or Boston?
Chicago and New York are usually in the one and two position.
You know, there's one other thing, too, which is as one gets older and now, you know, I don't know what to call myself, like in the...
You're not calling yourself a crone.
Senior years, the middle age. I don't know. But, you know, I feel responsibility to mentor younger generation, and in particular to mentor a younger generation of women. And there aren't a lot of women role models that young people in the arts have to look up to. I forget about that. But I think it's very, very important for people like Tanya and I to be there for the community and to be there as women who haven't given it up. I was an artist, too. I come from sculpture and performance art. And when I was in college, I had a teacher who said to me, you know, when you're in your 20s, there are many more people in the arts than when in your 50s and 60s, because most people give up, right?
As I did.
And so if you're still going at it, you can... young women in particular, reach out to me and have so many questions. But even young men who are trying to figure out what they're going to do with their careers or how to keep going in the arts and how to make a living and how to keep doing what's important. And I find great pleasure in being able to, as a human being, be there for people in that way. Because a lot of times people who are successful cut themselves off.
Because mentoring really is an important factor in the development of younger artists. But some people take the role more seriously than others. I have a feeling the two of you take it quite seriously.
I take it quite seriously. I have a lot of young women that I mentor.
On the other hand, the SAG Awards were this weekend, and the Oscars are coming up. And if you look at the proportion of men and women nominated for the kinds of jobs where either men or women can do it other than best actor, best actress, men are still dominating.
They are still dominating. I think the stats came out that though there were more women, there were less men who were directing television, the fewer men were getting more of the jobs. And I've been in the process of training to be a director in television. I've been shadowing on a lot of television shows. And it really just comes down to someone liking you and giving you the shot. It doesn't have to do with experience. They just have to like you. But if you can't get in the room or in the community, how are they even going to get to know you to like you? So having a mentor, someone who will take you to an event, that's something that Time's Up does. They have the Plus One initiative where you bring someone into a room that they couldn't get into, so they have an opportunity to make relationships with people that they wouldn't but for your invitation.
When I think of all of the actors who became directors, almost all of them were men. So is that just a natural process in the business? And why do some people choose to want to become directors and others are perfectly happy to continue just acting? I don't mean just acting.
No. I think it's a temperament. I took a clown class with Christopher Bayes, a Funny School of Good Acting, this weekend, and he said something, and I hadn't ever heard it, but when he said it, I thought it. He said, as an actor, you're just always being bossed around. No matter how old you get, they're just still bossing you around. And I think that's what it got to be for me, because, you know, there's always a new generation of writers and directors coming up, and you're in this room and your bosses are like younger than your children. And it's like, I need another position that allows all this wisdom and experience that I've accumulated for 46 years to be used in more effective ways.
Among your most notable roles was Sweet Anita in Jelly's Last Jam, the play that was based on the life of Jelly Roll Morton. But most people probably know you for your long time role as attorney Livia Fry on All My Children. Do you enjoy wearing all of your different hats?
I do. I don't think I could live any other way. I'm so curious, and I have so much energy that I need to be juggling a lot of balls at the same time. Like, you know, I'm about to go into a TV show tomorrow, and I've got a movie that we're going to Antigua next week to start shooting on, and I've got these plays that we're producing and two more. That is my heaven when there's a lot of balls in the air.
As a matter of fact, we had a very funny conversation about an hour and a half ago, which was, Tanya was like, oh my God, I'm getting on a plane tomorrow. I'm like, what? Where are you going? She's like,
because she has to be back here on Monday.
No, she has to be back on Sunday. I'm like, where are you going to go? I'm going to New Orleans. I'm like, what? You're going to New Orleans? She goes, yeah. And then after that, I'm going to Antigua. And I'm like, what? We have rehearsal on Sunday at 12. She goes, yeah, I know. I'll be back. I'm like, okay.
Well, the airlines must love you.
They do. I fly a lot. And I am never happier.
Aren't you glad
when I'm in a plane or train?
That everybody's back? In
right?
The airports?
Yeah.
Because that could have been really scary.
It could have been. I went on, you know, I couldn't find my passport, and I went online, and it was like even the online passport agency was really sluggish. It was like, oh.
So what are you doing in New Orleans and then Antigua?
I'm going to New Orleans to shoot NCIS New Orleans, and then I'm coming back, and I'm going down to Antigua with some collaborators, Kiara C. Jones of Cultivated Films, and I've written a feature called Bequest, and we're going down there because a whole section of the film takes place in Antigua around the ancestral lands, and they have a National Freedoms Day, which is in honor of the Africans who led revolts there, so that figures very strongly into this story of a woman finding herself through going back and finding her ancestry.
Well, it's great to be in demand as an actor, but do you see all of these things as working together?
Absolutely.
Obviously, if you're a good actor, you understand how to be a good director, I would assume.
Yeah, you know, doing soap operas afforded me the opportunity to do all the off-Broadway and off-off-Broadway theater I did when I first came to New York. It's funny because, you know, everybody knows Susan Lucci. She had TV shows besides being on All My Children. But when I kept getting work while I was working at ABC, there came a point when they said, if you're going to go do that little $1,200 off-Broadway show, you have to give back $10,000 of your salary.
And why?
I was like, that's what they required, because you're signing an exclusive contract to a TV show, and so they could have just said, no, you can't do anything. You have to sit at home doing nothing. So for me, I worked maybe two to four days a month. I had all this time and energy that I wanted to create, so I felt better giving them back $10,000 so that I could go and do something that was creatively fulfilling for
me. I would have thought it would be in their best interest for you to be appearing elsewhere, because one thing then makes people aware of you, and they get all excited about seeing you on the soap opera.
I'm sure that they got to have that and they got to get their money back too.
But working on a soap opera, that's kind of, it's not like anything else because you're doing a different thing every show. It's not like being in a play. It's not like working on a movie.
Best training ever. When you have to memorize 60 pages in a day and you just do it and you hit and run, it's fantastic. I did As the World Turns First, where I was the kid with Julianne Moore and Marissa Tomei and Steven Weber and Meg Ryan. We were the kids on that. And then All My Children, which was Chicago's number one show. And I get to grow up and be on that show. So, like, I've been living my dreams as an artist.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. We're back with our guest, Tonya Pinkins and Ann Hamburger, talking about En Garde Arts, which in association with WBAI and the Commons Cafe on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn is presenting Truth and Reconciliation of Women, curated by Tonya Pinkins, coming up this Monday evening at 7:30. And Tonya, you supplied us with that musical interlude.
Yes.
That wasn't you singing.
It was not. It was the composer, Angela Sclafani. And
she provided one of the pieces
for
that
Monday
will
night.
Be on Monday night. Not that piece.
That piece exactly will be on Monday night. Yes, and it'll be sung by a lot of women.
Because for 10 minutes?
I don't think it's 10 minutes. It's about a 5-minute song. Mm. No, it's not 10 minutes. Just things couldn't be longer than 10 minutes. Right. So the songs tend to be shorter. And that's a song that she was inspired to write after we had a conversation. She really wanted to write about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's going to keep coming up. We're going to have senators having to vote for more. So, yeah, let's have that song.
And maybe it'll inspire members of the audience to buy beer.
Okay, yeah, buy some beer.
So, this is part of a series called Uncommon Voices. But it's not beginning this coming Monday, is it?
No, actually, the first series we did was with this extraordinarily talented woman named Lisa Jessie Peterson. And she was working at Rikers Island for 20 years, and she did this developmental performance of this show called Down the Rabbit Hole, where she told stories about being a teacher at Rikers Island, working with teenagers. And she's just so incredibly talented, and the house was packed. And the hardest thing for me in doing this series is that every single artist that I present on these Monday nights, I want to produce the whole thing. So I have to exercise some self-control because there's so many incredibly talented people that will be coming through the door.
Two of your most recent productions, Bass Track Live and Wilderness, which you mentioned earlier, were New York Times critics' picks. Now, Bass Track Live was a documentary play. What is a documentary play?
The piece started at Juilliard with a guy named Ed Billos and Michelle DiBucci, who are music teachers there. And I saw it in workshop, and they had combined actual footage from photographers who were embedded in Afghanistan, both videos and photographs, videos of interviews.
So this is about the impact of the war on American families?
Oh, and veterans and their families, yes. So it was a combination of a four-piece electroacoustic score, these videos and interviews that were part of the kind of video design and live performers. And as I said, we took it to 40 cities. And I'm most proud of the fact that last January, we took it to Fort Hood and Killeen, Texas. Mm. We performed for over 2,500 soldiers. And the Intrepid Spirit Behavioral Health Center did a study and found that after these 2,500 soldiers saw the show, there was a 36% decrease in stigma by the soldiers that attended the show. So we literally are saving lives.
Because that's something Tanya's talked about as well. You said, Tonya, I've chosen to direct my time, attention, and talent now into building the theatrical pieces that model the world I want to live in and that I want my children and grandchildren to live in. So theater has the power not just to entertain or to make us think about the world. It's great seeing Shakespeare and Chekhov, etc., but also to make soldiers feel better about how about their experiences or about why they're reacting negatively to PTSD, accepting their PTSD and things like that?
In the Army, it's a huge problem that people who are serving or who have served don't go get help because it's a tough guy world. And so what our show really did was, through the storytelling, say it's okay to reach out and get help. It can actually save your life.
And I think it's Brian Dory who did Antigone at Athens up at Harlem Stage. He takes a lot of the classics into the military and finds that they also see this healing benefit to seeing those stories retold in ways that relate to what is happening to them today.
What is the play that you've written for next Monday, Now is the Time, about? It's not about Charlie Parker.
It is a group of women trying to decide what they can do to take control of their futures. And they, don't know. Some of them think they need permission, and some of them think they need to just strike out boldly. Hmm.
So it's about conflicting strategies in an activist movement.
Yeah, conflicting strategies.
And you think that the theater has that kind of power to act as a model for society?
I absolutely do. I think it has to be great artistically. And I think it can't be one-sided. It can't be pedantic. And it can't be what we also call pity porn. Like the next big show that we're doing is Undocumented. And it's a wonderful Latinx team that's going to be creating a fandango, which is a community celebration of dance and music. And it's coming from the stories of undocumented immigrants. But we don't
want... Written by Andrea Tome.
Yes, written by Andrea Tome, directed by Jose Zayas, and music by Sinue Padilla. But we don't want to just show undocumented people as, oh my God, they're homeless, they're poor, they're... they're in need of public assistance. They're undocumented people at all socioeconomic levels. They have rich and complicated lives. So it's about avoiding the kind of tropes that become cliches about some of these issues and really going deeper and working very closely with people who are working with these issues all the time to make sure you have your information right.
And I always think that this is something people don't think about in terms of immigrants, is that if you're really, really poor and you're in a war-torn country, you're just going to die. In order to immigrate, you have to have some resources. The people who are immigrating are the teachers, the business owners. It's not the lower class of any country that can immigrate because you can't afford to immigrate.
Right. Often they wind up in migrant camps because there's no other choice. Tanya, did you consider pursuing a career in law when you were in college? Lawyers can have a real impact on society. You started at California Western School of Law in San Diego. So what happened? Where did you go wrong?
Where did I go wrong? I got there and I was like, these people are really serious. They think they're like a curing cancer or something. And I just couldn't buy into it. This idea that you don't put your name on things and the teacher doesn't know who he's grading. I was like, that's ridiculous. The whole point of writing is you have a voice. The teacher's going to always know the voice in your essays. And so I just didn't buy into it. And my teachers would always say, you're such a great actress. You're going to be a great lawyer. And I would be like, I'm trying to tell the truth when I act. And they would literally say, it is not about the truth, it's about the proof. And if you can convince someone that 2 and 2 is 5, then you have done your job.
And when I've served on jury duty, the lawyers who were most effective were the ones who really knew how to present the case. They were bores, and even if they were defending somebody who was totally innocent, the jury kind of turned against them. But did law school help in your portrayal of Olivia Fry and All My Children?
I had done Olivia Fry long before I went to law school.
Oh.
Yeah, because I didn't finish college until 15 years after I started at Carnegie Mellon. I finished it in, 1996. So law school was about 1997. And I have used it. I've litigated. I've written winning appellate briefs. I found that actually if I had gotten a law degree, it would have been detrimental to me because the way I would fight would have been in such a way that they would have taken my degree away from me. And so I'm far more effective as someone who just knows the law and uses it on behalf of people.
But you are a fighter, and sometimes they get you into a bit of trouble. After you left the Classic Stage Company's production of Mother Courage, you wrote a letter that was published in Playbill. Had some people cautioned you not to do that? Colleagues and other actors and friends?
Actually, no. I had the assistance of Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the phrase intersectionality, and Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly, Eve Ensler, and Michael Eric Dyson were all of my editors in creating and crafting that letter so that it would make the most effective statement possible.
And what was, I mean, Brecht is... was an activist himself. What was your point?
If we had been doing Brecht, that would have been really wonderful. And one of the big lessons for me about that was I get so enthusiastic and excited to work with people that I don't say no at the right moment and I wait too long. We were not doing Brecht's text. We were doing a kind of, I would say, an abortion of Brecht's text. Mm. And there were just major cuts that cut the life out of this character, and it was no longer Mother Courage as he had written.
And would you advise other people to speak out when they feel it's absolutely going against what they believe?
I can't advise people to do that because there's a price that you pay.
You've been subjected to personal attacks.
Goodness! Oh, absolutely!
But why? You're so nice.
Well, you know about my rap roast video, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my rap roast video, where we took all of the hate that was about me online and we turned it into this amazing rap roast, which was one of the most fun things I'd ever done. Yeah, you got to take a risk. I mean, nothing. People who have power are not going to give it up peaceably. So you got to speak truth to power.
You had Isaac Klein compose the rap,
yeah,
and then put it on YouTube,
yeah.
And you got, what kind of response did you get?
The New York Times actually picked it up and did a piece about it. And it got quite a few hits. And it was just so much fun to remind people that being personally attacked is sometimes actually the way you know that you are doing the right thing. When there's a polarity about it, like these people are for you and these people are against you and you're half and half, it feels like you are really walking the line of something that is right on the bone.
And I'm assuming, Anne, that you agree because you're also doing cutting-edge things.
I have a lot of personal courage and resilience. I have a lot of personal courage and resilience as a human being. I think speaking out publicly in the papers, online, is a very personal choice. I'm someone who is very forthright in my opinions. I try to always look at things in balance, but feel it is important to fight for what we believe in while not falling prey to kind of divisiveness and finger pointing, because I think that there's way too much of that going on in the world right now, both sides of the political spectrum, the sexual spectrum, and what we really want to try to do, and this is why I love Truth and Reconciliation of Women, is try to learn from each other, learn from our mistakes, think about things in new ways, think about our own prejudices and judgments in different ways to maybe understand things that might be hard for us to admit or accept.
And it's really about people getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, because most minorities, immigrants, trans people, LGBTQAI people, are uncomfortable most of every day. And so other people have to get comfortable with their discomfort.
Have attitudes about messages changed? Remember the famous Samuel Goldwyn line, if I want to send a message, I'll send a telegram. Something, he said something along those lines, because people were asking him about those MGM movies that were kind of bland, although they were quite wonderful as entertainment.
You know, the fairy tale will never die, and every fairy tale is a moral. It's a message, and the heart of a good story is always a message, and a good story will trump a fact every time. And that's why I wanted to do Truth and Reconciliation. Yeah, there's a message. The message is, when I admit that I did something wrong, we both win. I don't carry that burden, you don't carry that burden, and we can go forward and do something great. So Truth and Reconciliation for Women is a great evening, because it's all an evening of celebration of people coming to this place of like, oh, okay, we can agree to disagree and we can move forward.
Did you say Trump effect on purpose?
I did not. But I do like to play bid whist, and you know those trump cards.
You once said that we need to laugh at ourselves as much as possible.
Yes.
So do you put any comedy into your work?
All of the plays I've done for Truth and Reconciliation are comedies. I did one about between Carol Bryant and Mamie Till, and it takes place in purgatory. And it is kind of a farcical comedy where Mamie is, you know, wailing and gnashing her teeth and at God for, you know, what he did to her son, Emmett Till. And then suddenly Carol Bryant shows up in her purgatory, and now she's really mad.
Yeah, well, your Roast Yourself Challenge also was... had a lot of funny things in it, and I have a feeling that added to its appeal.
I like humor. I really like humor, and I like laughing at myself, and I don't get to be funny enough. So, yeah, I'm always looking for an opportunity to make people laugh, because that is very healing. We know that laughter heals.
You've also said if everybody likes it, something's off.
Yeah. Yeah, except with the exception of Hamilton.
Yes. Well, actually, I saw two plays that lived up to the hype, The Book of Mormon and Hamilton. It's weird. You go in expecting to not like them as much as everybody says you should, but they both were pretty terrific.
Yeah,
you're nodding your head, Anne.
I've seen Hamilton 11 times,
oh,
and
my.
I could keep going back.
I love both of them. So I happen to know Bobby Lopez, who wrote Book of Mormon, and Kristen Anderson Lopez personally, because I brought them to Disney when I was there, and they ended up doing a show for the parks, actually, Finding Nemo was a musical, and that's how they met the Disney folks.
Disney actually brought a lot of good people on board. We recently interviewed Stephen Schwartz, who, after a long career with some really good plays on Broadway, then went through a lull in his career, wound up at Disney, and did great things there. So, and then came back and wound up giving us Wicked. But Disney spots talent, even if they sometimes don't necessarily give credit to the right people.
I was an outlier. I had been doing En Garde Arts for 13 years and creating large-scale site-specific pieces in New York City. And then I'd been at La Jolla Playhouse as the artistic director for 6 months when I got a call out of the blue from a search firm saying, we're looking for somebody to come in to found and run a global division for theme parks and resorts, creating all the large-scale entertainment. And I literally thought someone was playing a joke. But they hired me. So I thought, it's so fantastic to run a global division. And now I'm really happy to be back running En Garde Arts.
Doing theater. Most actors in the past started in theater and then went into the movies. And now it's actors going into the movies and then going into theater, often saying, the reason I make movies is so that I, do soap operas is so that I can afford to do theater. What is it about theater?
Theater is the only medium where the actor has all the power and control, and you are in a relationship with the audience. You can literally play the audience. It's visceral. It's sensual. There's just nothing like it. It's live. It's different every night. It's different every moment. TV and film cannot match that for a living experience of connection with another human being.
And the audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's interesting how audiences react to the same play each night. Sometimes a laugh line will get an uproarious response, and other nights it'll get a little titter,
right.
And another line will be the one that everybody goes crazy about.
Right.
So there's almost like this collective consciousness in an audience.
Absolutely.
Have you ever wondered why that is? Because in the end, it should be the mix should be pretty much the same every night.
No, because theater is acoustic. It's not digital. It is this acoustic thing, and the weather, and the building, and who's in the room, and what they came from. Like it's an augury in a certain sense. Like if you could capture a moment of theater in time, it would be an augury of that moment in a historic sense. So that's the excitement, is you never know from one night to the next. What's it going to be?
It also has to do with generational references. When we did Wilderness, the very first preview, we had 200 students from NYU's psychology department come. And when we had one of the actors in the play talk about Frank Ocean, the musician, all the kids like cracked up. And when the adults came, they didn't know who Frank Ocean was. So a lot of it has to do with people responding to generational references.
But that works the other way as well. A lot of people are concerned that younger people are not going to theater as much as their parents and grandparents did.
I don't know. The box office's records are not saying that.
Well, you know, when
we're seeing different kinds of plays being produced to appeal to millennials.
Mm-hmm.
I do have to say, when we were at Fort Hood and there were 2,500 soldiers in the audience over 5 days, these are guys that don't go to the theater. And one young man in uniform walked in and said, "Oh my God, this is going to be another PowerPoint demonstration about how I shouldn't kill myself," because he would never go to the theater. And after he saw the show, he was like, "I've never seen anything like this. This is so amazing." And so I was like, this is why I do this.
Yeah, it's sacred and holy, a group of people gathering together in a dark room. There's an intimacy to it, and there's a way in which you also can be alone in your own private world. One of the things I always love about the theater is when you come out after performing and someone, you know, tells you how much they love this moment that actually wasn't in the play, but it was the play they needed to see, and you're just like,
But we also are aware of just how powerful theater can be by the fact that Sophocles is still performed, and
the Greeks.
It goes back a long time. In every culture, There is a theatrical production. People, this is something that people come to naturally.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, we have this performance on next Monday, and it will. Is just a one-time thing?
No. Truth and Reconciliation of Women will be at the Hashtag Heal Me 2 Festival 3 Sundays in March and April.
Mm-hmm. March 27th through April 14th.
The 3 Sundays. We close that festival out. And then we will be at the 14th Street Y all of the weekends in July 2019. And there are talks for it to go other places.
And are the two of you talking about future projects?
Not yet, but
because you
I'm
seem to be having so much fun together.
Well, I adore Tanya, but adore I'm sure we will. So, in order to get tickets,
yes, I was going to ask you. Truth and Reconciliation of Women will be at the Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, for one performance only next Monday, February 4th at 7:30. How can our listeners reserve seats?
So they can go to the En Garde Arts website, and it's spelled engardearts.org. Tickets in advance are $17.50.
No prices.
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, that's how they can get tickets. Mm-hmm. And
they'll find out the prices.
And they'll find
they're
out
reasonable.
The prices.
Believe me, it's a lot less expensive than going to a Broadway play.
Exactly. And the doors open at 6:30 if you want to come have a bite and get a glass of something.
Yeah. They've got some amazing teas in the Commons Cafe. And
that's it.
Yeah.
And how much are tickets to Hamilton?
Well, that depends if you get them at the box office or from a scalper.
My great thanks to both of you so much
for being on our show.
It's
always a pleasure.
Tanya Pickens and Anne Mendelsohn, it's been so great having you here. Anne Hamburger, I'm so sorry. I did have an Anne Mendelsohn on the other day. But
Annie Hamburger is my name.
Yep.
Thank you, Leonard.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Tanya Pinkett and Ann Hamburger, to Kate Guan, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.